Hi, this is Tracy Swedlow, Editor-in-Chief of Interactive TV Today and Radio ITVT, and the co-producer of the TV of Tomorrow show, which is coming up June 13th and 14th. And we're really happy to have Brendan Gahan.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, yeah, thanks for being here.
You pronounced it right.
Okay, great.
I'm shocked. Nobody ever gets it right, but you did.
What, how do they pronounce it? Gahan?
I get Gahan, I get Gahan, I get Gone, all of the above, yeah.
Maybe even Cohen?
I haven't gotten that one yet, but I would not be surprised at some point.
All right. Well, we're really thrilled to have you here. You are the founder and EVP, or the founder of Epic Signal. What's your actual title?
Yep. Founder and EVP, Executive Vice President, but I started it.
So, like, you're the main poobah. Does anybody use that word anymore? But, you know, like, because
yeah,
I noticed
yeah,
that.
More or less.
That's good. Although I wanted to wish you congratulations. From what I can see, you recently won an award through the DigiDay video program. For Best Video Advertising Agency and Partner.
Yep. We're very excited about that. That was, I think that was three, four weeks ago we got that. And we're really excited.
So let's try to define, you know, what it is that Epic Signal does. And I want to remind all the listeners that Brendan will absolutely be speaking at the next TVOT show on the 13th and 14th in San Francisco in June. So we're happy to have you there. So you're a video agency, advertising agency partner, but you do, I think, more than that. You really try to develop, you know, all kinds of video advertising, not just for the influencer, you know, using the involvement of or incorporating the involvement of the influencers, but you make videos in general for advertising partners. Is that correct, or is there more?
Yeah, and there's more to it. We think of ourselves as a social first agency. I would definitely say our big point of differentiation is in video. I mean, across the board, that's the direction that all things social are really going. So we've really invested in that skill set, whether it's working with influencers and creating, you know, branded content, as well as, you know, managing communities for brands. It tends to be a big part of the mix, but we're not limited to that. I mean, like I said, you know, we'll do influencer marketing. We do lots of community management, you know, the production, analytics, day-to-day management associated with that. We'll do branded content on behalf of brands and various activations, as well as a bit of paid social as well.
So once you get a particular project, you know, you basically are not only creating video assets, but, you know, perhaps the whole sort of ecosystem around that, those assets, and reporting back to your client?
Yep. We'll do everything owned, earned, and paid.
Owned, earned, and paid. Somebody should make a t-shirt that says that. let's see. So let's talk about, first of all, I want to find out, when did you actually found the company? Because, I mean, managing influencers, you know, is, you know, relatively recent phenomenon in the last few years. So has this agency been around even earlier than 2 or 3 years?
Yeah. So I started it around 5 years ago, give or take. It was independent and then sold it to Mechanism, which is a larger creative agency, about 3 years ago now. We've been at it for about 5 years, but within the space, like I've personally been in the influencer marketing space for a while. I did my first influencer brand deal back in, it was like 2006 or 2007. I just started in advertising. I was at my first, you know, real job in advertising at a small agency in San Francisco. And we had a client come in that didn't have a big budget, and the partners at the agency were ready to pass on it. And I was like, hey, I got this idea. Why don't we, work with these kids on YouTube who are just crushing it and have, millions of views every video they churn out, and let's pay them to do some branded content. And I was very fortunate that the guys I was working for were really open to new ideas and like the fact that I was really passionate about it. And they're like, sure, you can take it to the the brand. We pitched it, they bought it, and I did my first brand deal back. Yeah, it was either late 2006, early 2007, and it was with Smosh, who is now I mean, just massive, one of the biggest YouTube channels out there. And I think when Variety did that study that showed that among teens, the majority of the most recognizable celebrities among teens are YouTube stars. Smosh was like number one. Like, they're the most recognizable celebrity today among teens. So been at it for a while, and pretty much from there, just ran with it and continued to do a lot of influencer marketing at, in my various roles.
Well, there's a lot to sort of discuss in that. I mean, and now I wanted to point out that you're working with, a lot of big brands on your site. Mountain Dew, Amazon, Starbucks, Pepe, Pe Pepe, Pepsi, YouTube, and many others. But so now you're looking to, not only satisfy the needs of your clients, but the influencers themselves, in some ways, even though they're getting paid, I mean, to some extent, you need to serve their interests, or else, I mean, to what extent, do you have to convince them that, they're going to get all this money and they just jump into it? Are they just, when you approach them, they're just, desperate, they need to figure out a way to, to make all this, continue? Or are they looking to enhance their visibility, bring interesting new content to their audiences? I'm trying to figure out what the dynamic is between the
Yeah,
spectrum
totally.
of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I think it's a good
Because
question.
they all want to be authentic to their community. They don't want to lose audience. So, like, how do you balance those two needs? Because I know they all want to make a living out of what they're doing. I mean, I'm assuming it's a big conversation you have to have when you approach that influencer right away.
Yeah, 100%. I think it is always a balance. We definitely try and be very tactful, and certainly not. If an influencer is not into a project, it's definitely not a good idea to kind of push the topic. But generally, the way we approach it is, I think we've kind of managed to navigate it so that we find ourselves in situations, we avoid those situations where we're doing anything that, would be quote unquote inauthentic. And generally, the way we approach that is, when we get a brief from a client and we're going to be working with them on an influencer project, generally what we do is we'll sell them the big idea and kind of what the desired outcome is. So, all right, we have a rough idea of what the influencer campaign should look like. We know that a win is, whatever it is, X number of views or X amount of engagement around the content. And then we work with the brand to develop a criteria to establish, all right, well, based on the type of content we want, based on the type of activation we need, the results we want to get, and overlaying that with who their target demographic is, who would be appropriate for the campaign, who's brand safe, all the psychographics and demographic information. We'll work with them to develop what that filter is for the influencers, and then we'll go out and build out an influencer list, and we'll make it much bigger than we need to, and work with the clients and go through basically like, all right, who do you feel is brand appropriate? I mean, ultimately, they know the brand best. And so we'll red line whoever is not, ultimately brand appropriate. We'll still have a much larger group than we generally need. And then we'll just go out and have conversations with people. And it's nice going about it that way because we have flexibility where it's like if somebody's immediately very excited and they're like, oh my gosh, I love this brand, this activation, all, you know, everything that comes along with it, I want in, we're in a position where we can pull the trigger. It's all sold through already. Whereas oftentimes where I think where brands and agencies get themselves into trouble is they get so hung up on a specific influencer. And you almost find a dynamic of, can I swear on this podcast, by the way?
Go for it.
First. Okay. Where there's like, you know, for lack of a better term, starfuckers, you know, it's like there are big, you know, influencers out there who are kind of gaining mainstream notoriety, and you'll work with certain brands and they're just like, I want this person. And then the whole campaign execution lives and dies based on whether or not you get that particular talent. And that's not an ideal scenario because then you kind of backed up into a corner. You generally make compromises, maybe you throw too much money at the problem. So we really like to focus on the idea first and then back into the talent with a much broader pool of approved talent than we generally need. So there's, I think that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was saying, when you find these people, do you have an agency or a set of agencies you go through that they've already, you know, joined, or do you research all of this yourselves through, you know, the different sites that show who's doing well with traffic and, you know, engagement numbers, and, you know, like that, the article on ROI influencers and things like that.
Yeah. We'll basically build out internally, you know, as we're building out these lists, we'll be pulling their metrics across, you know, whatever appropriate platform. So usually oftentimes we'll just do all the platforms because more often than not, you know, people are going to be cross-promoting their content everywhere. And we'll be looking to see kind of both reach as well as engagement across all platforms and see, you know, we'll check out engagement rates and all that stuff and share that with the client and make sure that it's all backing into our criteria, our established filter before we even engage any of those guys. And then in terms of the outreach itself, you know, we handle all that. We're you know, agnostic in terms of who to work with. So if talent is, you know, part of a management company or, you know, have an agent or they want us to deal with their lawyer, we'll do that. But generally, I mean, at this point, we have so many personal relationships. It's oftentimes, you know, we can deal with talent directly or, you know, we're just as happy to deal with their managers or whoever ultimately is going to help us get the job done.
It's interesting then, that okay.
Oh, go no, ahead. No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. And then I was going to say, so the other piece, which I think just kind of going back to, you know, earlier in the conversation where you were asking about, like, you know, what the reaction to the influencers are and kind of the marketplace. I mean, we have lots of conversations with them up front and definitely make sure, A, that they're very excited, and B, have a clear understanding of what they're walking into. So there's that component. But then I think another component, which is often overlooked, is like, just because we're working in a digital space, I think oftentimes there's the desire or the habit to keep things within digital. So you end up, oftentimes these influencers never even meeting the brands. You know, they're not dealing with them face to face. You know, it's all over email. And I feel like that's very impersonal. And you want people who are representing the brand to be really excited. So we try and do a few things. One is more and more we're pushing to do long-term brand deals with talent because ultimately, you know, these guys do have to make a living. And you want to get category exclusivity as much as possible. So, like, if somebody is only doing a one-off brand deal, yeah, you can get category exclusivity for a while, but it's not going to be permanent. And then ultimately over time, if they're working with a competitor, whatever, 6 months from now, a year from now, that kind of dilutes both the brand equity as well as the influencer kind of credibility. Mm-hmm. And so we really try and do, wherever possible, really long-term immersive programs. Treat them the same way you would that, like a celebrity endorsement contract. You know, like have them come out for appearances, you know, have them do branded content, always hook them up with swag and products so they're always, you know, really amped, have them, you know, do regular check-ins with them, all that stuff. The other piece is we really try and onboard them to the brand in a way that's really fun and kind of that mix of education and entertainment, the candy with the medicine. So, you know, oftentimes we'll do like influencer summits where we'll, you know, fly them all out. They'll get to meet the brand team. We'll do some fun activities. They'll like hear from us, you know, about the context of the campaign, how we got here, walk through all the timelines and logistics, and then, you know, go out and have a good time and get them to know the brand team and us, the agency as people, and get them really excited and ideally along the way provide some sort of exclusive access that they can share with their audience. And all that stuff really helps build that, credibility. You know, they're going to be out there talking about your brand all the time. It's best that they're doing it from a really knowledgeable place that they and make sure they have that understanding versus just like, oh, I'm going to look at my email and, you know, put these bullet points in my, you know, my own words. Like that just doesn't translate as well. But sorry, I kind of went off on that was a long-winded way of answering your question, but I'm done. I can dive into
you. I think you answered various questions I had lined up, but that's all good. So to what extent did these long-term relationships that you're building, have you ever developed any sort of original content out of this other than ads? Or is there sort of storytelling opportunities where it might be branded entertainment rather than branded advertising. To what extent are we moving in that direction or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's ultimately all got to be, especially with the influencers, it's got to be an emphasis. Like, entertainment has to be, at the center of it all, for sure. I think definitely from an overarching philosophy and strategy standpoint, we very much try and make sure that is the takeaway. And just putting an ad, particularly into an influencer's, video, just wouldn't translate. Because ultimately, like, they establish a real relationship with their audience. I mean, oftentimes the relationship that the fans have with the creator is much more akin to a friendship than your typical kind of celebrity fan relationship. So we definitely try and keep that in mind. And I think in terms of kind of what that looks like from an execution standpoint, we try and go in with a very simple brief and kind of what the core deliverables are, and then have the creator come back with how that is brought to life within their existing format. So that there is a lot of flexibility and they are saying it in their own, words and expressing it in a way that's very, familiar with their audience for sure. In terms of kind of like actually making real, entertainment versus it being ads, we have done a few campaigns where we've kind of, I think it's beyond just making sure that the content itself is entertaining, really approaching it from almost like developing like shows kind of format. And we did some campaigns with Amazon promoting Amazon Fire, where we actually had, because there's so much content out there on these OTT platforms, it can be tough to navigate. And so we actually developed shows and we bring influencers in to basically highlight in various episodes, here's great content to watch. And it was like all content that would be relevant to like that influencer in their audience. So comedian influencer would talk about their favorite comedies and where to find them and that type of thing. And then another kind of experiment along similar lines is with Mountain Dew, we actually created a multi-channel network on behalf of the brand. And so it was actually...
And you made a lot of, you had a lot of traffic, from what I understand.
Oh, yeah, 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 totally. And so, so both of those
like hundreds,
are kind of
hundreds of millions of views and...
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. And that's where it's nice, like, developing those long-term relationships with the creators. It's like, they're just, the brand's always around. It's part of their, you know, their persona and their channel and all this. And so, you know, you obviously they have core deliverables, but then it just gets naturally integrated into their content.
Well, I want to shift gears a little bit, because if you're spending so much time with influencers, I wonder if there's more investment in that area, since that's one of the main things that you do, versus, say, having your clients say, let's go after some celebrities. Because, you know, the millennials, but talk about the kids coming up underneath the millennials, right? They know more about those YouTube influencers than they know about a lot of celebrities. I mean, look at the traffic from the Oscars, right? The viewership is going down for establishment media. So what does that say about, you know, where you think your clients should invest their money? Or maybe they still, if you get a celebrity up there, you know, you're still going to get a lot of traffic. But I don't know. I've seen kids see a famous influencer and they go completely nuts.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
about a screaming.
Certainly. Oh, yeah. I mean, you go to VidCon, you're walking around and it's like every influencer is like, you know, it's like Justin Bieber is walking around or something. It's pretty incredible. And so for us, I mean, definitely we are drinking the influencer Kool-Aid to a certain extent. And it is something, I think it obviously works incredibly well. And B, it's the direction things are trending. That's not to say that, you know, I want to make sure that it's clear. I think there's a space and there's opportunity for both, and oftentimes the kind of lines are very blurred, especially nowadays anyways. But it's like also not just because you're working with an influencer, it's going to be a slam dunk. And just because you're working with a celebrity doesn't mean it won't work. There's, you know, there are very, you know, poorly executed influencer campaigns and they're awesome. You know, celebrity, you know, traditional celebrity-driven campaigns. But I think generally from a macro kind of trend perspective, it certainly is heading towards more and more relevancy. And, you know, with the digital influencers, and for us, you know, that's where we see the opportunity for our business, not just because, you know, it's our business, but also because, you know, we've seen it just work incredibly well.
I'm kind of curious what you think a great influencer campaign might look like. But then the question after that, just to put this in your mind, is as much as you put into these campaigns or these amazing videos that you put together, you're still punching them out over online media. And, you know, of course, we've seen that there's a massive challenge going on YouTube, et cetera, where the algorithms are being changed fairly frequently, and the influencers are complaining that, you know, their subscriber numbers are being manipulated or going down, or things are being unsubscribed, but then people, they still keep growing. It's very confusing as to, you know, the environment, whether it's sort of stable, right? So there's this, mm-hmm. on one hand of the spectrum, huge popularity, constantly, you know, you're seeing growth in subscriber base, and yet the influencers are saying, you know, they're challenged. So I guess the first question is what's a great influencer campaign, and how does that fare in this currently challenged environment?
Yeah, totally. Well, I think for a great campaign, that's a good question, but I think ultimately it's like a win if, you know, the client gets their message communicated and walks away really happy. The audience gets content that they love, and the creator walks away happy and with some sort of exclusive experience. Like, you really got to get those, you know, it's like a Venn diagram. It's like audience, client, and influencer. And where those overlap, if you can get those overlap, that's a win. And it's difficult because oftentimes there's inevitably some sort of there's friction there. But I think that's where really making sure you're being really thoughtful and establishing what that criteria is for the influencers, and then having real in-depth conversations with them and making sure they're excited about it and understand what they're walking into. Because oftentimes people get excited and then they don't totally. Maybe they weren't reading all the paperwork, and people walk away less than happy. But I think, and then also making sure that you take that extra step to invest in them as much as you want them to invest in you. So I think that's very broad, but I think that's ultimately what a great campaign looks like. And then in terms of the way the algorithms and stuff are changing this, and with some creators being, there are lots of complaints about demonetization or changes in the algorithm. And it's an interesting time right now. Luckily for us, it's like, so long as there are, you know, it's not a universal, you know, all influencers are suddenly... wiped off these platforms, we're set, because there is naturally going to be an evolution in terms of, you know, different people will rise and other people will fall off. And, you know, we're not managing talent. We're working on behalf of our clients. So we're neutral in terms of that side of things. We're not going to bring any kind of bias in terms of who they should work with, because we're managing anyone. So we can roll with the punches really easily in terms of those changes. And in fact, oftentimes it'll work to our benefit, because, you don't have kind of like a set group always at the top that can demand top dollar. It's always kind of shifting.
There are new platforms to explore all the time, right? If one is having some algorithm change problems, I'm assuming that you explore some other platforms.
Totally. Yeah, like, you know, Facebook right now is really, in the video space, becoming a contender, whereas, you know, just a short while ago, it wasn't even on anyone's radar, really. It was all YouTube. And, and then, of course, you've got Instagram and Snapchat and so on. So yeah, it makes it fun. I think that's where the opportunity is in those changes. But I think, you know, it's interesting what's happening. I think big picture, you know, there's the platforms are responding to this desire for brand safety. Obviously all the platforms make money from ads, and they need sticky content to keep people coming back. Unfortunately, oftentimes that sticky content tends to be extreme and so on. And because these are tech platforms, it's not like they're manually being reviewed. And so naturally what's happened is extreme content, whatever that ends up being, is sometimes not brand friendly, and then brands find themselves running ads against content that they find objectionable, and that has happened enough that these guys have gotten enough bad press, and they're trying to figure out how to solve for this, and the way to do that is in the case of like what YouTube is doing, is they're threatening and executing on demonetization of content that they deem to be not friendly for advertisers. And when you're dealing with the type of scale that they're dealing with, I mean, what is it, like, you know, 500-600 hours of content being uploaded every minute, they're never going to be making mistakes.
But there, I know there were complaints that the political commentators out there, right, They're commenting about how, you know, they'll get censored if they start mentioning, you know, that they're critical of this political person or that political person, or they want to bring up, you know, topics like, I don't know, gun control, or what about this conspiracy theory, or what do you you know, things that are just in conversation all the time. And they're complaining that there's somebody out there at YouTube who is, who has decided keywords, you know, like, it could be anti-Semitism, it could be breast surgery, it could be, you know, things like this, that will then will force the unseen algorithm to demonetize them. And it's so, because I watch these platforms a lot, and I see all of the influencers commenting on this. It's just, it's a big problem.
Yeah.
I mean, there's still a lot of growth and opportunity, but I know what's going on.
Yeah, totally. And I empathize with both sides, because it's like YouTube, I mean, they're massive, and it's like, there's no way they're going to make everybody happy in this. I mean, it's really going to be tough with the amount of content that they've got. I mean, I'm sure they're always going to be evolving this, but it's like across the board, you know, I've got friends that are YouTubers, and, you know, regardless of what their topics are, political or otherwise, and most of the time they're very confused as to, or maybe not most of the time, oftentimes they're very confused as to, what was the thing that led to this video being demonetized? It doesn't seem like there's a rhyme or reason behind it. And that's, I think, the nature of working with, you know, algorithms and you know, working at such a massive scale. Even if, 1% of videos are incorrectly demonetized, that's probably like, what, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of videos a day. That's a lot. That's a massive impact. I know it's actually, it's much, you know, for some channels, it's, you know, their monetization has dropped something like, you know, I've heard people talk about 80% drops. It's tough, because also you got to realize, all right, so I empathize with YouTube. It's a massive undertaking. But you also want creators to invest in your platform. So you can't, you know, kind of, you've got to keep them incentivized, but at the same time, it's also like the creators got to understand that, you know, those ad dollars will dry up if YouTube can't prove that they're a kind of a safe platform for brands. And so I think we're going through some serious growing pains, and also, you know, while it is difficult, you know, for the creators, it's also the nature of working on a platform you just don't own. And it's like, that's kind of the trade-off, is you're inevitably going to come up against a lot of things that you won't like. But you also have access to, a massive platform and all these tools that come with it, and the ability to build an audience and tap into this community that YouTube has cultivated. So I think, for a lot of these creators, you know, I think they have very valid, I mean, they definitely have very, very valid complaints.
Didn't you set up a special site for the Mountain Dew Project? Wasn't that like you were calling it an MCN, but was that, I mean, I'm sure it appeared also on YouTube, but I mean, of course, that's how I saw it, but to what extent should brands be creating their own streaming service, their own community, where you know, interested fans can come, they can attract them? I mean, why rely on YouTube at all?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And I think it goes back to like the trade-off. I mean, the benefit of, you know, all these platforms is the ability to tap into the community, leverage their technology, and you don't have to go out and build it all. And who goes to microsites anymore, or who goes to websites without it being shared on social first? Oftentimes it's just way more streamlined to just go straight to the source and start uploading on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. You could certainly invest a lot and try and develop your own community on your own platform, but that in this day and age, it's so difficult. I mean, people are spending so much time just using Facebook as a way to figure out what they should be looking at. And if you're not, you know, popping up there, you're not going to be relevant. And you know, YouTube is the second largest search engine. And you know, it kind of same thing. It's like if you post a video on your microsite and it's hosted by a third party, it's not on YouTube. You know, what does it then take for you to get somebody there to see it? Probably a lot of money. So it's just not. I think from a cost benefit standpoint, more often than not, it is worth investing in these platforms, but you certainly give up a lot of control.
Right, but I mean, to some extent, you know, if there are benefits or, you know, special savings or, you know, some kind of thing that makes going to that microsite worthwhile, I'd be curious, you know, if those would ever succeed. I don't know if they, if that has been measured across the sort of marketplace. I'm sure maybe it has been measured. Someone out there, let me know. Okay. Now, what are you looking for in influencers? Do you just find them at the conferences where they appear? I know you're on the board at VidCon, but we certainly have influencers that show up at TVOT if people want to meet them. But, you know, what are you looking for? Do you want people who are creating videos about specific things like food and fashion and sort of those obvious categories? Or are you looking for somebody who just has a huge amount of subscribers and you just sort of collect them and then you, like you said, you just sort of make sure you've got a whole list so when you get a client, you've got them on tap. Are you looking for any particular type of influencer right now?
Well, no, not necessarily. It's because it's all very bespoke. You know, with every campaign, we, you know, we'll work with that brand to craft that list from scratch. You know, I think you brought up a good point. You know, is it just about the audience size or topic? You know, I think the short answer is it varies based on the client needs and objectives. And I think there's definitely the misconception that, oh, you've got to be huge to, you know, be relevant and palatable to a brand, and that's not always the case. I think you know, it really just depends on what the brand needs are. But I think somebody who's unique and has, you know, a unique perspective and has carved out a niche for themselves, and as a result has a really passionate, engaged community, can certainly be more valuable than somebody with, you know, tens of millions of subscribers. I think oftentimes, you know, there's this threshold where when somebody's a little bit smaller, their fans are super passionate, engaged, and they can just drive incredible results. And then when they reach a certain level of notoriety, that community has more kind of casual viewers, and that just doesn't translate as well. So I think ultimately, you know, it varies, but it's not all about the numbers by any means.
Well, I think that answers all my questions, unless there's something that we didn't bring up. Because there's a violin playing in the background, and I don't know if you can hear it.
No, actually, I can't.
Oh, okay. She's playing some Bach in the background.
Oh, awesome.
Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I think I guess a couple of things. One is, I think, you know, the influencers as a whole, that space is really valuable. And you know, Facebook has been making a lot of algorithm updates, but these guys tend to still have really rabid, engaged communities. And then I think the other thing is I feel like the big opportunity with the creators, you know, the influencers out there right now is still relatively untapped, and that is developing those really meaningful long-term partnerships and collaborations. I think most brands tend to still look at it as, oh, we're going to do this one-off, And I don't think that's beneficial to you know, the brand, the creator, or the community in the long run. And I think that the big opportunities for, you know, brands to you know, work with these guys and develop, you know, endorsement deals akin to, you know, Michael Jordan and Nike. Like, we don't have that in the digital influencer space. You know, this icon that just is incredibly involved and representative of the brand as a whole. And I think that's really the direction things will eventually head. And I think that's a big opportunity. And in the meantime, I think the creators will fill the void by developing their own brands, and ultimately those might even, you know, end up competing with the more traditional ones.
You know, in fact, I mentioned before the call, Mike Chen, who has spoke at our New York show last December, and he has a channel called Strictly Dumpling. And, you know, he's doing, he travels around the world sampling food, and he gets paid to travel. He's a great guy if you guys need him. But he is out there making new, you know, sauce brands and things like that. He's, you know, lending himself to making products that relate to food. Mm-hmm. So it seems like the influencers are definitely finding those opportunities to generate an income as well. I have no idea how much all these guys are getting paid, you know, if they can, you know, really make a living out of this during the year. Some of them are.
Oh, yeah. Some of them are doing quite well, for sure. I mean, yeah, there's definitely, just because, you know, you're an influencer doesn't mean you're immediately a millionaire, but there are certainly quite a few out there, for sure.
It would be interesting someday for someone to break down, you know, in detail, you know, what this sort of, what are those financial opportunities and whether they get an agent and that whole world. We'll have to discuss that at TVOT. Maybe I'll do that. All right. Well, thank you very, very much, Brendan. I really appreciate it. What projects are coming up? Can you talk about them? We didn't go there yet.
Let's see. Well, I can't go into the specifics, but we won a big alcohol brand, and we'll be announcing that at some point, and you know, doing some PR around it. But that's we're really, really excited about. It's a very, very cool brand. We're going to be doing lots of cool work. So that's something I'm personally very excited about. And otherwise, just generally,
yeah, because you get all those
growing.
Free samples.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'll put that to good use.
Okay, well, maybe will you be able to discuss it in June at TVOT, potentially? Will the
Hope
news
so.
Be out by then?
I think so.
Okay, good. All right, well, looking forward to it. Be sure to check out their website, which is... what is your website? EpicSignal.com. EpicSignal.com. So thank you so much, and we'll be pairing you with all kinds of amazing people at TVOT. So stay tuned for Brendan Gayen, who's the founder and EVP of Epic Signal.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Appreciate you having me on.
No problem. Thank you. This is Tracy Swedlow, and be sure to check out tvotshow.com for the latest about the conference coming up. And, of course, Radio ITBT can be found at itbt.com/podcast, and you'll find all kinds of podcasts that reaching back into the past and news and updates about TVT. Thanks so much. Take care.